Baby, it's way cold outside. Today on The World. With parts of the U.S. in a shocking deep freeze, it might be hard to grasp, but the big picture, global temperatures are still rising.
This big cold snap that we're experiencing in North America is not saying that global warming isn't happening. The globe is still warmer than average.
Also today, President Trump wants pressure and sanctions on Iran, but Europeans want to do business with Iran, and they say they found a way. And the legend of Pancho Villa lives on.
This was one of the figures that had heroic moments and horrifying moments and has become an iconic, legendary, mythic figure in Mexican and Mexican-American history.
Pancho Villa, the opera. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you here. It is wicked cold here in Boston, and we are far from alone. 75% of the U.S. population will see temperatures fall below freezing this week. Some of us are used to this kind of weather. Mia Atokiak lives in Cambridge Bay, Nunavut. Her town is way, way up north in Canada, above the Arctic Circle.
So yeah, the temperature here in Cambridge Bay, Nunavut, right now is minus 55 with the wind chill and minus 40 without the wind chill. So it's a little hard to walk outside because it's just so cold.
That would be 40 below and pretty normal, Mia says. So how do people in Cambridge Bay make it work?
Driving snowmobiles at this time of year because our trucks are frozen. I mean, for example, my truck has been completely frozen for the last week, has not been able to start because at one point in this week, it got down to minus 60 with the wind chill.
Mia tells us the real problem in far northern Canada isn't cold winters, it's warm summers. Up there, they build their houses and everything else on the permafrost, and the permafrost is melting.
In the last few years, because of the hot, hot summers we've been having, a lot of permafrost has melted. That causes huge cracks in the earth all around Cambridge Bay because we've been having hotter summers.
Far west of Nunavut in Alaska, people are noticing a warm winter. Tim Marshall-Cogdill helps organize the Willow 300 dog sled race in Willow, Alaska. The organizers had to cancel the race this year because of unexpected rain. Cogdill wants to make sure mushers and dogs alike are safe, but he didn't make much of the rain.
You know, this is Alaska. Our weather changes continuously. We deal with the weather on a weekly basis here. It is what it is, and is it unseasonably warm? Sure, you bet.
KTUU's meteorologist Jackie Purcell, on the other hand, says that this week alone has had a striking difference in temperature. But she's been in the state for a while now.
And I also grew up in Anchorage, Alaska. I can truly say that, yeah, we used to walk through some very cold weather on our way to school. You cannot count on having a good snowpack for the entire winter season anymore. And just this past winter, our local ski resorts had to delay their openings because of inadequate snow cover.
So parts of Alaska are warmer than usual, and we know that much of the U.S. is colder than normal. This is all about the out-of-whack polar vortex. I'm looking at a map showing temperature differences today across the whole world, and it is not what you'd expect. Jennifer Francis is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center in Falmouth, Massachusetts. I know you've seen this too, Jennifer. So can we go over it together? It looks like places like Alaska, Western Russia, the Arctic, they've got this red-orange blob over them, and places in the Midwest have a deep purple cold blob. So that means cold places are warmer than they should be, and places that are sort of cold are extremely cold.
That's true. And you're looking at a map of the entire world. I know the map you're looking at. And I think what's striking to me is that there are really only two places in the whole globe right now that are significantly colder than normal for those places. And that is right over the Great Lakes, Midwest, in the North American continent, and then similarly over Northern Asia. The rest of the globe is pretty much warmer than normal. So this big cold snap that we're experiencing in North America is not saying that global warming isn't happening. The globe is still warmer than average.
Is it safe to say it's colder in Chicago than the Arctic.
Yes, it is colder in Chicago than it is in many parts of the Arctic right now, by a fair margin, I'll say.
So we've mentioned the Midwest, Alaska, Western Russia, and the Arctic. What other places are being affected by the polar vortex and why?
First, we should probably just really say what the polar vortex is, because it has, that term has been misused a fair bit over the last few years.
Yeah, so what is a polar vortex?
Yeah, so the polar vortex really lives in the stratosphere, which is a layer way up in the atmosphere about 30 miles above the surface. It's a big pool of cold air that normally sits over the Arctic, and it's surrounded by a band of very strong winds. And those winds keep that cold air trapped up there most of the time. But what can happen is that normally quite circular polar vortex in the stratosphere can get disrupted. It happens naturally, usually a few times, you know, every 3 years or so. And when that happens, we tend to see warm air in the stratosphere instead of cold. And instead, it can break up into these separate circulations. So instead of being one big circle of wind with cold air in the middle, it can break up into two or even three blobs. And when that happens, those lobes of cold air tend to migrate southward, and that's exactly what's happening right now. So we have one of those lobes of cold polar vortex air sitting over the center of North America. Mm-hmm. It brought all of its cold air with it, and that's what's making this particular cold event so much more extreme than just, say, your run-of-the-mill cold spell.
So you see this polar vortex, this disruption, as a natural disruption?
It's probably got some component of natural in it, but we also are finding that new research is connecting these splits in the polar vortex to that very warm blob in the Arctic that you pointed out. And so what we think is happening is that when we lose a whole bunch of ice, sea ice, in the region north of Western Russia, which is right where that hot spot is that you mentioned,
yep.
There's a lot of extra heat in that area that gets out of the ocean, goes up into the atmosphere, and it tends to make like a bulge in the atmosphere right there. And if it's strong enough and big enough and it lasts long enough, it can actually cause one of these collapses of the stratospheric polar vortex. So there is some research that suggests that this is happening more often. We're seeing these splits in the polar vortex happening more often, and it could tie back to the fact that we're losing so much sea ice in the Arctic in the last several decades.
Yeah, so I haven't really heard the phrase climate change anywhere in that explanation. Is there a connection?
Well, that's the reason the sea ice is disappearing.
So you're saying there is a connection?
I believe there is a connection. It is still emerging science, and it still needs a lot more work, but there's some very compelling papers that have come out just in the last couple of years that connect these complicated dots together and paint a picture that looks a lot like what's happening right now.
Jennifer Francis is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Research Center in Falmouth, Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us, Jennifer.
You're welcome. Anytime.
U.S. and Chinese officials have been meeting in Washington this week to try and head off the trade war that's been brewing between the two biggest economies on Earth. A March 1st deadline looms over these talks. That's when President Trump says he will slap more severe tariffs on Chinese goods. China's President Xi Jinping would like to avoid that. Don't expect any quick breakthroughs, says Bonnie Glazer. She's a China expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We reached her earlier as she was about to get on a plane, so pardon the background noise. Glazer thinks that despite the tensions between Washington and Beijing, there is some room for compromise.
I think, yes, the Chinese can purchase more goods from the United States. They can open up their market more and maybe more quickly than they have been. They can stop forcing American companies and other foreign companies to transfer technology as a condition of doing business in China. But when it comes to things that are really part of China's industrial policy, like subsidizing state-owned enterprises, I think the Chinese are unlikely to make those kinds of compromises. So the question is whether the Trump administration will accept less than they have demanded so far.
When you listen to Trump, isn't he simply saying and acting on what a lot of U.S. presidents have said about China? Like, when it comes to business, they play unfairly. They're running up a trade deficit with the U.S. They won't open up their markets. Does Trump have a point that the U.S. needs to be tougher on China?
Yes, I think he does. And President Obama did call many times for a level playing field in economic ties with China and presidents before him. And there are many countries around the world. This is really not a bilateral issue. Germany, Japan, really all over the world. World that are making the same complaints. Some are doing so more privately than the United States is. But China is the biggest trader in the world now, and it joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, said it would abide by WTO rules, and has not completely done so. And when the Chinese violate the rules of the global trading system, it's not like a small country violating those rules. It has a really significant impact. So, yes, President Trump has a point. I think many U.S. and also foreign companies and governments support President Trump in his assessment of the problem, but they don't necessarily agree with his prescription for the solution, that is, imposing tariffs.
What is a better solution?
Well, the United States could work with other governments collectively, seek reform in the WTO. That's likely to take time. But jointly, we could create more leverage, I think, if we are working with other governments trying to put pressure on China rather than doing so unilaterally.
So, Bonnie, I'm also curious, with these 2 days of talks in Washington, how is the fight over Huawei and their detained CFO in Vancouver, Meng Wanzhou? I mean, she's slated for extradition to the U.S. Is that interfering at all in these negotiations right now?
It certainly could interfere. President Trump has already indicated that there might be some way that Huawei could be used as a bargaining chip to get a better trade deal. I think that that probably violates U.S. law. This is a Department of Justice investigation and should in no way be connected with the trade talks. However, we saw last year that when the United States was filing charges against another Chinese company, ZTE, that Xi Jinping reached out to President Trump and essentially asked for a reprieve, and he got one. So the United States did not pursue the indictments and charges against ZTE. So I expect that the Chinese may try to do the same thing with Huawei. But the fact that this is taking place simultaneously, I think, really does muddy the waters.
Is there political pressure on both sides, though, to come up with a win at the end of these 2 days of talks?
I don't think there's political pressure to come up with a concrete agreement as a result of these 2 days. I think there's some political pressure to make progress. I think it would be damaging both for Xi Jinping and President Trump if it was a complete failure. So I think that's just not likely to happen. The real question is, as we get closer to this deadline, March 1st, do the U.S. and China say, okay, we're making progress, we will extend these talks and the deadline, maybe another 90 days, and we will seek to get more. But the political calendar is relevant and ticking, I think, for President Trump. As he gets closer to the presidential campaign, I think there is pressure on President Trump to deliver a win. Tariffs are not a win. They're not a victory for President Trump. And as he faces more criticism in Congress, he cannot do very much to advance a domestic agenda. I think he will be increasingly looking to foreign policy for some victories. And we could see that with China, and we could also see a deal with North Korea. Not necessarily good deals, but we may see some agreements.
Bonnie Glaser with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with us from Dulles Airport. Safe travels, Bonnie, and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's harder than ever to get a higher education in this country. Average college tuition and fees have more than doubled since the 1980s. When you start talking undocumented immigrants, the financial costs are prohibitive. Getting documented does help a lot, but doesn't clear away all the hurdles. Reporter Jude Joffe Block met one family determined to get that degree.
Ana Chavarin grew up in Mexico and loved school. She can never forget the disappointment she felt when she was 13 and her mom needed her to drop out and earn money.
Working in a factory and observing other kids passing every day at 3, and I was inside working and they were like laughing with their backpacks, and I felt like my mom somehow robbed me from that.
It left Anna with a craving for education and a drive not to repeat the mistake with her own kids.
Because I know what I gave up.
Anna started her own family and moved here to Tucson without papers. She hoped to give her 4 kids the schooling she never got. Meanwhile, her life was low-paid jobs, housekeeping, dishwashing, cleaning offices at night.
I had always wanted to come back to school, but then I couldn't because I was undocumented.
Undocumented immigrants in Arizona don't qualify for in-state tuition. So at community college, they pay a rate that is 3 times higher, and they can't get any federal financial aid. Then, a decade ago, when Anna was coming home from cleaning one night, something horrible happened. She was attacked and sexually assaulted.
Just a random stranger who took the opportunity because he saw the moment.
Anna spiraled into post-traumatic stress disorder. Therapy saved her. She met other sexual assault survivors who needed counseling in Spanish. Anna realized that was her calling, to become a bilingual therapist and help others overcome trauma.
I was like, this is the moment. And that's when I just ran to adult education and got enrolled and started the process to get education.
The first step was a GED, then college. But she was still undocumented and couldn't afford it. To Anna's surprise, she qualified for a rare immigration visa, known as a U visa, for crime victims.
I know that many immigrants dream to have their documents. The way I got them is not the best way. That is not something that anybody wish. But at least after surviving that traumatic experience, something good came out of it.
With her visa, Anna got in-state tuition. She enrolled in Pima Community College part-time since she has 2 jobs, and her eldest son, Jorge, followed in her footsteps.
How was your day?
It was all right.
Jorge is 21. When Anna got her visa, he and his siblings got documented too. Mother and son now bump into each other at the college cafeteria.
I got an 88,
oh my God,
yeah.
You just told me you got an 88.
Yeah, I got an 88 on my nutrition exam.
That's good.
Yeah, that's all right.
Are you satisfied?
No, but it's all right.
Like his mom, Jorge also wants to help people. His dream is to become a registered nurse. Jorge says his new immigration status and his mom's example made this path possible.
Her being so motivated to first get her GED and then be the first one to go to college definitely gave me that motivation to, like, I got to do it as well.
Even with documents, though, it's been hard to pay for. One semester, Jorge couldn't afford tuition and worked at a gas station full-time. Anna relied on small scholarships and donations.
I bought my books with credit cards sometimes, or sometimes I made copies.
A little over a year ago, Anna and Jorge became legal permanent residents, which made them finally eligible for federal financial aid for school. But Jorge still works 30 hours a week. Anna works more than 65 hours as a community organizer and as a janitor. And on top of it all, Anna is a single mom of 4. Jorge has 3 younger siblings, ages 13 to 17. After the attack, Anna's marriage ended, leaving her alone with the kids.
Anna, what have you been playing without my watching?
It's almost 11. This slice of the night, after school and work, is the only window Anna and Jorge have to study.
I told you, my brain is tired. I forget Spanish and I forget English.
Despite how hard this is, Anna is determined to keep going in school, all the way to a clinical psychology PhD. So far, after 5 years of part-time classes, she has her associate's degree. But a doctorate could easily be another decade or more.
But I try not to think about how many years, because it's discouraging.
Instead, Anna thinks about the day she'll have a diploma on the wall for her kids to see. The younger ones are already talking about studying law, graphic design, and psychology.
I just want to inspire them and to see that if I did it, they can do it too.
By the time she finally gets her PhD, Anna says, maybe her children will be parents as well.
And probably they can tell their kids, like, look, Nana did it, you can do it too.
For The World, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
Check out more of our coverage of migration and education issues at theworld.org. All right, see if you recognize this voice. Yeah, we're not making it easy on you. It's Mariah Carey. She's in Saudi Arabia right now, and that's her performing at a concert there. She was invited to perform as part of the country's first major international golf tournament. It is a big deal for Saudis. Just ask this young man, a serious Mariah Carey fan.
I love Mariah Carey. Like, ever since I can remember, I've been in love with her, like her music. I have a very personal connection to her.
Carey's invitation comes at a time when the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is loosening restrictions on entertainment, but not everyone is excited about celebrities jetting off to Saudi Arabia to showcase their talents.
I was very shocked. All these Saudi activists were very shocked to see that Mariah Carey have accepted the invitation.
Omaima al-Najjar fled Saudi Arabia and now lives in Italy. When she heard Mariah Carey was going to perform in Saudi, she started a campaign to boycott the concert. She and other activists say Carey is giving legitimacy to the crown prince at a time when the prince should be held accountable for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
We know that there have been artists who came to Saudi Arabia during December, and it was at the same time the scandal of Jamal Khashoggi's murder. But what is different this time is that Mariah Carey is a woman, and she's a much more influential artist.
Carey responded to these criticisms, saying that she sees this as an opportunity to end gender segregation in Saudi Arabia, to which al-Najjar, the activist, responds,
"It's very flawed, ignorant, and superficial. I mean, she's ignoring the worst humanitarian crisis in the world in Yemen. She's ignoring the fact that Saudi Arabia killed journalists and other activists have disappeared, and we believe that they have been killed." So it is very obvious that she is trying to come with a pathetic excuse for accepting the money.
Vision of love? Maybe it's more a vision of money. Still I believe. And a quick note before we take a break. Yesterday we had a story about Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk known to many as the father of mindfulness. Our story referred to the self-immolation of a Buddhist monk in Saigon back in 1963. We mistakenly said the monk was protesting the communist regime. In fact, he set himself on fire to protest the South Vietnamese government's anti-Buddhist policies. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. El Salvador holds a presidential election this weekend. It's about personality, one candidate's personality in particular.
He can say anything and get away with it, but there's this mystical aura around this personality, which is an enigma.
An enigmatic frontrunner in El Salvador. That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Isolation, pressure, sanctions. As far as the Trump administration is concerned, that's the way to deal with Iran. Europeans have other ideas. They want to do business with Iran. Today, Britain, France, and Germany launched a new program to do just that. It's called the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX.
It's not a terribly beautiful acronym, is it?
Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council.
But it is a means of facilitating trade between Iran and initially the European Union that will not, the organizers hope, violate sanctions and will permit Iran to get some of the benefits of the nuclear deal that it is still abiding by.
And why does the EU say this is needed?
Well, the problem has been that since the United States pulled out of the deal unilaterally last May and reimposed U.S. sanctions, this has put a chill on the willingness of Western banks to deal with Iranian banks, even when we're talking about food, medicine, other things that are not sanctioned. They're just simply terrified that somehow they're going to fall afoul of the Treasury Department of the United States. And so this mechanism will essentially circumvent banks entirely. It's kind of a ledger there will be a record of what Iran provides to Europe, what Europe provides to Iran, and then at some point the difference will be settled in some non-dollar currency. It's possible that other countries, Asian countries, might participate. Russia might participate. Mm.
So we're essentially talking a barter system, and the ledger would kind of show exchanges of oil and pomegranates from Iran and whatever would be coming from Europe, right?
Yeah, probably not oil. There isn't that much Iranian oil going to Europe. So it's a good question, actually, what Iran will be able to sell to Europe. Mm. You mentioned pomegranates. You know, there's saffron, caviar, Persian rugs, things like that, I suppose. Also, some manufactured goods, actually, that Iran has an advantage in producing. I mean, the Europeans will have to figure that out. They might find some convoluted way. For example, the Swiss have figured out a way to sell Iran pharmaceuticals and get paid with Iranian oil revenue that the Japanese are amassing.
And they're already doing this outside of Instex?
This is outside of Instex. This has just been approved, apparently, by the Treasury Department. I mean, we're going to see a lot of very strange pool, you know, with sort of money and goods kind of pinging from one side of the world to the other in order to get around the U.S. dollar.
Will it be effective, Instex?
That's a really good question. I mean, the working assumption is that small and medium-sized European companies will avail themselves of this. Companies that do not have exposure in the United States and that have longstanding relationships with Iran, that they will be the first to step up. Now, what's happened is it's been registered. No goods, no money has gone through it. That's still going to take a little while. But I think the symbolism of it is really important. There's been a lot of pressure in Iran coming from some factions suggesting that Iran should just pull out of the nuclear deal because they're restricting their program and they're not getting the benefits that they were promised in return. So hopefully this will be enough to convince the Iranian leadership to stay in the deal and to wait out the Trump administration.
But, Barbara, you know there's no denying Iran's Revolutionary Guards are involved in destabilizing activities across the Mideast, and Iranian agents have even been busted trying to assassinate dissidents in Europe itself. So why are these European governments trying to help Iran?
Well, I don't think they want Iran getting a nuclear weapon on top of all of the activity that you just mentioned. Let's remember what this deal was about. It was never about changing everything about Iran. You know, there was a hope that it could be a foundation for more negotiations, for other changes in Iranian activities. But it was a nuclear deal. And Iran has been abiding by that deal, as our intelligence community just announced yet again this week, even though the president doesn't seem to want to believe it.
Do you think the U.S. might retaliate against countries and companies that use this new Instex marketplace?
I don't think so, because initially the trade will be confined to things like food and medicine, which are not sanctionable. But, you know, this is a precedent that the U.S. has to worry about, because if it works, it will diminish the power of the United States to really control what goes on in the international financial system. The power of the dollar will be diminished, and others will be looking for ways to get around U.S. sanctions.
Barbara Slavin, Iran expert at the think tank, the Atlantic Council. Always good to speak with you. Thanks.
Thanks. A pleasure, Marco.
President Trump today once again singled out El Salvador. He criticized the government there for allowing people to flee north into Mexico and toward the U.S. southern border. On Sunday, Salvadorans head to the polls to choose a new president. And it turns out migration is not the central campaign issue. The buzz has almost exclusively been about the presidential frontrunner. He's a 37-year-old mayor presenting himself as something new. Emily Green reports from the capital, San Salvador.
His name is Nayib Bukele. He exudes coolness with a closely trimmed beard and array of colorful socks and leather jackets. He comes from a prominent business family and started his political career in 2012 as mayor of a small town. 3 years later, he became mayor of San Salvador and embraced social media. In October, he officially confirmed his presidential campaign on Facebook Live.
Que si queremos que todo lo anterior cambie, necesitamos no solo ganar el 3 de febrero, sino arrasarlos en las urnas, a ambos.
If we want to change the past, he says, we need to not only win, but to crush the other two parties. Bukele's candidacy is a challenge to El Salvador's two-party rule, ARENA on the right and FMLN on the left. Bukele was part of FMLN until 2017, when the leftist party expelled him for reasons that are disputed. Now he's running under a small party associated with the extreme right. Bukele's appeal is personal, not political, says elections analyst Alvaro Artiga.
Él no está proponiendo así un giro dramático en algún tema.
Bukele isn't proposing any radical policy changes, Artiga says. What he's created is an illusion of hope, that things can be different. And voters in El Salvador want an end to the corruption. One former FMLN president is accused of embezzling $351 million. He fled to Nicaragua. A former ARENA president is in prison for embezzling $260 million. A third former president faced criminal charges for stealing millions of dollars. He died before trial. Those scandals, among others, have voters from both parties flocking to Bukele. At Bukele's final campaign rally, around 3,000 people fill San Salvador's central square. Rap music blares as a diverse crowd awaits his arrival. Dilma Martinez says she always voted for FMLN, until now.
El Frente nos traicionó, ARENA jamás. Por primera vez tenemos la tercera opción y esperamos que este sea...
The FMLN betrayed us, she says, and she would never vote for ARENA. For the first time, there's another option. Susana Ulloa came with her 16-year-old daughter.
No, no le puedo decir que considere que el hombre es el Mesías ni es Dios. No, pero prefiero conocer algo nuevo.
I can't say that the man is a Messiah or God, she says, but I prefer to try someone new than go back to the old that I know. As the event draws to a close, I go to a bar a block away, La Dalia. It's a historic bar with tall ceilings, pool tables, cheap beer. A few years ago, most Salvadorans wouldn't dare come here. For decades, the historic center was too dangerous. Bukele changed that as mayor. He negotiated with the gangs and got them to back off. It's his crowning achievement, says Arisbel Arismendi. She's a reporter with the publication El Faro, covering his campaign.
Su mensaje ha sido básicamente, no soy corrupto, lo pueden ver, puedo remodelar.
She says Bukele's message has been, I'm not corrupt, you can see that, I rehabilitated the historic center so regular people can enjoy it. Bukele has said that as president, he would also build a new airport and revive an abandoned train line that runs across the country. But on hot-button issues, he has offered vague promises.
Y no vemos hasta este momento una propuesta clara, ni de seguridad, ni de cómo va a lograr frenar.
Arismendi says Bukele hasn't articulated a plan for addressing two of the country's biggest challenges, violence and the mass exodus of Salvadorans to the U.S. He's also skipped presidential debates and largely avoided interviews with the media. He relies on Twitter and Facebook Live to communicate his message uninterrupted. Johnny Wright is a former congressman with the ARENA party and a Bukele critic. He says Bukele has been masterful at turning criticism of him to his benefit by claiming the political establishment wants to bring him down.
He can say anything and get away with it, but there's this mystical aura around this personality, which is an enigma.
But an enigma may be preferable to the status quo for a majority of Salvadorans. Bukele is hoping to win the presidency outright on Sunday. If no candidate wins more than 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff in March. For The World, Emily Green, San Salvador.
Cliff Sims is making the rounds with his new book, yet another account about the chaos inside the Trump White House. Sims worked as a special assistant to the president. Unsurprisingly, Trump has dismissed this new book as fake. I wanted to hear more from Sims about the moment when he cornered White House policy advisor Stephen Miller and advocated on behalf of Syrian refugees. Sims says that Miller told him, "I'd be happy if not a single refugee foot ever again touched American soil." Sims says the exchange was shocking because he'd traveled to Syria's border and met refugees in person.
The refugee issue is one that I struggle with a great deal because of my personal experience. When we talked about it, I didn't see it in the abstract. I saw the faces of those children and those the people that I had met there.
You write that there's nothing quite like stepping out of a Middle Eastern airport by yourself, a lily-white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed American knowing just enough Arabic to get by. So how did your experience set you apart on the Trump campaign trail and once you got to the White House?
It made me one of the few who had had that kind of firsthand experience. And I didn't talk to anyone else in the White House who had had that experience. Certainly, there are plenty of people working in the government, State Department, and maybe even in the West Wing, certainly in the national security space, who have spent time in that part of the world and have firsthand experience in that part of the world. Stephen Miller is not one of those people. And so I was just trying to bring that
apparently,
to a little different
yeah.
perspective.
So where does that perspective, Stephen Miller's perspective, where does that come from?
Well, you know, with Stephen, one of the things that I really respect about Stephen is he has a fully formed worldview. And he really believes the things that he believes, and he fights for those things. And I think those are commendable parts of Stephen's character.
But are there commendable things for a democracy? A country that's built its reputation on accepting refugees and immigrants.
Sure, sure. A lot of people attach race to that and want to say that it's bigotry. My experience, to be honest, I did not find it to be that way. While I thought that a lot of that was wrong, I did not think that it was motivated from a place of bigotry, from a place of wanting to maintain a certain. I'm kind of thinking through this as I talk, but it's like more of like maintaining the society that we have culturally. And so I think it's actually a totally fair
thing to
point out.
That's the argument, but how can you say that when Stephen Miller says something like, I'd be happy if not a single refugee foot ever
sure.
touched on American soil again, how can you see that as not bigoted?
Well, so I certainly disagree with it.
Yeah, well, I guess we can go on and have a debate about what we actually expect of people who come to this country. And
I think that's a worthwhile debate. I think it's totally a conversation that needs to be had.
Yeah, well, we can have it another time. I want to ask you about the Trump White House claims that God is on their side. I'm thinking of moments like when former Attorney General Jeff Sessions used quotes from the Bible to defend the separation of parents and children at the border.
And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13, to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders backed him up.
It is very biblical to enforce the law. That is actually repeated a number of times throughout the Bible.
And Cliff Sims, you probably know about the interview the other day that Sanders gave to the Christian Broadcasting Network and said this.
I think God calls all of us to fill different roles at different times. And I think that he wanted Donald Trump to become president, and that's why he's there.
So God wanted Donald Trump to become president. You're a devout Christian, Cliff Sims. But, mm-hmm. I mean, is that mix of politics and religion healthy for a democracy?
So I think those of us who are Christians do believe that God does ordain events on earth to happen. There's a danger that you can, in doing that, that you are implying that God is in favor of everything that those people do. And using the Bible as a policy defense is something that a lot of times I don't feel comfortable with for a lot of reasons. I would tend to want to shy away from that most of the time and make the arguments on the merits of the policy.
To get back to the policy then, Cliff Sims, how do you face the Syrians you met on the border of Syria and Jordan and explain to them, sorry, you can't come to the United States?
That's tough, and I plan to go back over there and continue to do that. But I don't necessarily think that the solution to this is that the United States needs to have this giant open policy where everyone who's a refugee should be able to come here. What I would like to be able to tell them there is, you know, we're going to do everything we can to help resettle you here as close to your homes as possible.
Cliff Sims, former special assistant to President Trump. His new book is Team of Vipers, My 500 Extraordinary Days in the Trump White House. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your thoughts.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Francisco Pancho Villa. You've probably heard the name, but I'm going to guess many of us would have a hard time explaining who he was. Quick intro, Pancho Villa was a key figure in the Mexican Revolution a century ago, fought against authoritarianism in Mexico, took part in battles on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, led a guerrilla war. That's never pretty, so let's just say Pancho Villa was a complex character. The perfect subject for drama or an opera.
Era el 23 de junio, hablo con los más presentes. Fue tomado Zacatecas por las tropas insurgentes. Ya tenían algunos días que se estaban agarrando cuando llegó Pancho Villa a ver qué estaba pasando.
Pancho Villa, From a Safe Distance, is that opera. The scene describes the 1914 Battle of Zacatecas, a decisive victory for Villa and his revolutionary forces. As the narrator vocalizes, archival photos float across a screen on the stage.
Ángeles, Urbina y Villa planearon la operación, iban a tomar los cerros y acabar con las tropas del usurpador.
What is the shorthand for the Mexican Revolution when you're dealing with just Pancho Villa?
In a complicated, contradictory, convoluted, long, long war, this was one of the figures that had heroic moments and horrifying moments and has become an iconic, legendary, mythic figure in Mexican and Mexican-American history.
That's Graham Reynolds, composer of Pancho Villa from a Safe Distance. I sat down with him after a recent performance of the opera in Brooklyn.
It's the very impressionistic portrait you paint of Pancho Villa. What is that portrait telling us?
He's so complicated. I wasn't interested in like a biopic, straight narrative. I wanted more of a collage. Even when you study the revolution in order, it's a confusing thing. So I wanted you to get that impression of who do you side with. Like in one song, he seems like a hero and you're ready to join the revolution. In another song, he's slaughtering somebody's family for no reason.
An impressionistic opera. For some people, though, Pancho Villa is very real.
I really love the character of Pancho Villa because part of my family is from Chihuahua State.
Chihuahua, on the border with the U.S., was Pancho Villa's old stomping ground. That's Luisa Pardo, one of the opera's librettists. Did you think it was kind of a crazy idea to do an opera about Pancho Villa, or did it make perfect sense?
I think both. It was very important to do this link with the past. And yes, to try to do a reflection about how we can change the society, not with violence, but yes, we have to know that this society must change.
Luisa Pardo says creating the lyrics around Pancho Villa as a subject was also personal. Switching to Spanish, Pardo says her own mother was a guerrilla leader in Chihuahua and felt a connection with Villa's struggle on behalf of the poor.
In my own education reflected that. We had this object at home and read it on it was a prayer to Pancho Villa. That kind of says it all about how my mother felt about him.
But remember, Pancho Villa was no saint. He was responsible for a lot of bloodshed in the Mexican Revolution. How have you come to understand Pancho Villa? Is he a hero or is he a villain?
I'm going to say in Spanish better.
Okay.
Creo que es las dos cosas y ninguna de las dos cosas.
I think that he's both, hero and villain at the same time. Pancho Villa was a human being whose destiny was to play a major role in history. He's contradictory, but in any case, of all the characters in the Mexican Revolution, Pancho Villa is one of my favorites. And that doesn't mean he didn't make serious mistakes or committed grave injustices.
Muchos años, todo día, sin descanso, gobernar.
The opera Pancho Villa from a Safe Distance will be performed tonight in Vancouver. And if past performances are any indication, there will probably be Pancho Villa descendants in the audience. Here's Graham Reynolds again.
When we started this, I figured I'd run into some people that had some stories of a distant relative that had some association with the revolution. Not only did we get that, but person after person with my grandfather wrote with Pancho Villa. My grandmother's ranch was raided. Like, all sorts of stories. Then we go up to Seattle, and this guy comes up to me, and he looks exactly like Pancho Villa. He says, "I'm Rufino, I'm Pancho's grandson." And of course, I was worried about what he would think, because there are some very dark things about Pancho Villa in this opera, and we don't really hold back. And he was all hugs and excited and very proud of the piece, and he had brought his daughter, so we had Pancho's great-granddaughters. Then he shows up in New York bringing his sister, Celia, Aunt Celia, who brought a whole folder of birth certificates, and she's determined to let you know she's the real deal.
Celia Contreras Villa Wendell.
So tell me how you are related to Pancho Villa.
My mother was his daughter. So that makes him my grandfather.
Yes, Pancho Villa's granddaughter was at the performance I saw with her birth certificate to prove her connection. And she had lots to say.
My grandfather, you know, he loved the ladies. I mean, but anyway.
You made the sign of the cross, Sarah.
Yes, I did.
Think everything's going to be okay.
Right, you got it. So anyway.
Yep, Celia admits there are many layers of complexity to her grandfather's story. Again, hero and villain. By the way, if you're wondering why the opera is titled Pancho Villa from a safe distance, that's a reference to a specific place. The Hotel Paso del Norte in El Paso, Texas. It has a unique connection to the Mexican Revolution, and it's where Graham Reynolds first got the idea to write an opera about Pancho Villa.
It's a place that you can see right across the river into Juarez, and during the Battle of Juarez, the people would go up to the rooftop as spectators and watch the battle with their opera glasses and parasols and all that. So Pancho Villa, from a safe distance, the title is about those people, where they were able to be fascinated by this legend, this myth, this leader that was right there, but they were very safe.
Pobre, pobre, pobre Pancho Villa. Vende triste su destino, Pancho Villa.
We heard there from Graham Reynolds, the composer of Pancho Villa from a Safe Distance, and also from Luisa Pardo, one of the librettists. Well worth the price of admission for this opera, in my humble opinion. And that's curtains for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.